the spacecraft sighted, flying high above the sky. Sirens declare there's one among us.
Torpedoes, volunteers, we need volunteers, soldiers to meet them. Have no fear, you will be killed right away.
I will take the girl from Venus, flowers die and so will I. Yes, I will kiss the girl from Venus
for science.
I'm so brave, I'll be her love slave.
He's so brave, you'll be her love slave forever.
Yes! I will take the girl from Venus, flowers die and so will I. Yes, I will kiss the girl from Venus
for science.
Those missiles ready to destroy the universe.
You said if these models have some validity, obviously certain things you can rely on predictions and say if they're actually able to make predictions, then there's some more validity to that model. But also we might be able to say something that you can quantify or have some sort of quantifiable result. Matt said you might be able to speak more to the idea of this zero point energy. There's a lot of people out there now. The vortex math-based, engines, let's call them, to sort of tap into that. There's different ideas of how one might tap into this free energy or zero-point energy. What do you think is sort of the current state of that research?
Matt and I were just talking about that a little earlier. Once we had to reschedule, we sat down for a bit and talked about that. I'm not as well acquainted with the vortex math of Randy Powell, and I'm forgetting the originator of it.
Roden.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting, and I can't comment on it because I'm not as familiar with it. Now, I understand the motivations of it for what it's trying to accomplish, and so for that, that's an interesting idea, but I don't know how they're going about it or what that tells us about how to extract energy. What I go from is like what technologies, as sparse as they are, which ones have seemed to have worked and what principles are they operating on. Now, that based on that, I can see the relevance of the vortex even without this mathematical structure that they've invented, or I don't know if he's invented it or built off something else, but it might be helpful, and it might help. Certainly you can't have any kind of like working technology without some kind of, you know, guidance in your mathematical engineering and what have you. So I'm sure we'll need something like that. But as of now, in terms of what guides theory for me and like how these things are working, it does have to do with the vortex, which is a self-organizing structure, which again has relevance from subatomic particles to organisms to the universe. So it stands to reason that it has something to do with our energy production as well, at least certain modes of it. And so it seems the nuts and bolts of it, and the long and short of it, is that these machines or whatever they are accumulating some kind of vortex motion or some kind of cyclonic motion or impulse that is creating a self-organizing action in the vacuum, and then it draws it into the machine. Okay, so that's the best reasoning that I can come up with, and that's in a very general, broad, non-specific, without referencing anything way of putting it. And so it's like, well, where is this stuff coming from, and how, and what is the relevance of that geometry? And that's where I see it coming in. And so you could model really the vacuum as kind of a hyperbolic or a cyclonic, or even the way Paul LaViolette does it, in these dissipative structures, they're like cyclones. I mean, you look at them, they're just like spirals, and they're these really beautiful geometries, and they organize in this way. So what we're talking about is self-organization and kind of how that applies to stuff all over the place and how we're in a creative universe. And so we're tapping, really, when you talk about zero-point energy, you could say we're tapping the creativity of everything, because that's where particles pop out of nowhere, and then, you know, light comes out of nowhere. And you could argue that because that's the background white light, everything we perceive it's like we're looking at that screen, you know, we're not even looking at what we're doing is we're abstracting off of it. We have equipment in our eyes and our brains to abstract from that background field. So you could say that it's not only relevant for our energy, but it's like how we perceive things too. You know, you could call that like an illusion or whatever, but I mean, we still live and die. But where every reality is generated, I think that's an interesting question too. But anyway, so zero point energy, that is basically, there's a lot of ways to think about it and model it. But if we're talking about tapping it, there seems to be some kind of like resonance you can get into with it. And I'm sure Matt has some ideas on that too, because he's investigated a lot of technologies and seen some firsthand, and he could probably shed some light on that.
No, go ahead. Okay, it sounded like you were going to say something. The about Rodin, actually, Rodin and Powell, one thing that really intrigues me about what they're doing is there seems to be an overlap or perhaps a connection with feng shui. Because feng shui is actually involves a lot of the same math. It involves, well, what I would call mod 9 arithmetic. They might have. I don't know if they have a different name for it, but that's essentially what they're exploring. And the, so feng shui. There's different schools, you might say. One is, was it Flying Star Feng Shui? I took a class in this once, and it's all about using the numbers 1 through 9 and how they cycle, and actually different ways in which you cycle them, even some interesting number theory stuff that they call like the sieve of Saturn, or sigil of Saturn rather. And this, you know, allegedly ancient methodologies is all about how chi moves through a space, through a house, for instance. And there's very similarity. There's a lot of similarity between this type of math and even the math that John Searle himself of the Searle Motor did, because he did a lot of these magic squares, and he actually generalized it to like magic cubes, so that you, if you have like a three-dimensional grid of these cycling numbers, and he would take it up to 4, so you have a 4x4x4 cube. With all these different numbers, and these would get, when you solve for them, it would give you the various parameters and ratios of the of a free energy device. So, you know, someone from academia, you know, maybe myself from 5-6 years ago, would just dismissed a lot of this stuff. But you know, there's something here. It's not enough for me to pursue it actively right now, but I'm glad that someone is. Yeah, so I don't know if as far as the free energy, I mean, I have seen the Searle Motor, at least a what you might say, not an actual full running machine, but a prototype that demonstrates a handful of its principles. And yeah, I mean, they're doing interesting work. And they have funding, you know, and from various countries, and so every time I meet with them, it's pretty exciting as far as what they've been up to. But you know, in a way, free energy is like the modern philosopher's stone. I think it's
absolutely, yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, I mean, it's still fairly elusive. You know, I think actually John keeps up with the various developments more than myself. I tend to go deep into something, where I think he's more about breadth. And so I usually, when I want to know what's going on, I tend to talk to John and ask him. Yeah, I don't know if there's any specific direction you want to go, or.
No, I guess I just was sort of curious, since, you know, I think particularly on the internet and in our, I don't know what we're going to call this, alternative research fields and things like that, this gets thrown around a lot, that there, you know, the technology exists and it's being, you know, suppressed.
Yeah.
And I think there's a very good case for, I mean, plenty of suppressed innovations. That being said, I guess for two, I have the opportunity today to speak to two people who would actually understand. All right, I had a guy on, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Christopher Knowles. He does sort of cross subjects, but he's not a science guy, but he talks about just having been someone who's observed the alternative research community for so many years. He talks of this idea that, you know, you have like a DARPA or a somebody, you know, so these big money ideas, and they say, oh, we figured out how to do this. And he says, there's a big difference between coming up with the idea on paper and actually getting it into a working something.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever he sort of poo-poos the free energy field as, well, it's one thing to have it on paper, but there's so many things we have on paper that don't work. And then again, you have this whole other side where it's saying, oh, it's real. We're just being, the elite is putting us down and making sure we have access to nothing. Suppressing this thing that could feed everybody. I guess I'm sort of curious, as two people who understand the working concepts behind it, how realistic do you think these ideas are? Or is it in our future? Is it a philosopher's stone? Is it a something we'll be chasing with no real results, or?
you want to go first, John?
Yeah, I won't spend too much time on it. I'm going to let you have a crack at it.
Okay.
The way I see it is that both sides are being pretty unreasonable. There's a little bit of truth in both of what they're saying. The way I see it is that what we have is a technology that is not ready to run everyone's homes across the country. I think we don't really understand what we have. We have something very relevant and clearly gives us power. Now the question is like how to make use of this stuff, what materials we use, what the output is, really getting a lot of eyes and ears and hands on it to figure out what we're dealing with. Now, I've heard it equated historically to like the Wright brothers when they were just starting to get their planes off the ground. And I think that's not a bad analogy, historically speaking. Now, it's not that there's not, I think there's been at least four or five technologies that I've seen pretty well documented that I've been pretty convinced of. And the rest, I mean, take it or leave it, really. I mean, it's interesting, and there might be something there, but we don't know. They're just stories. But going off what I know of what stuff is, I think has worked in the past, I can start to judge, like, well, what's behind this? Have I seen this before? And so you can exercise some filtering. Clearly, some stuff is in black projects. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's there. There's enough of a paperwork trail to indicate that. But at the same time, what I think is just like, this is not a technology that's just ready to go out in the open. Now, it might be, and I could be wrong. There could be something much bigger just holding it back. And there is to a degree, but what's holding it back almost is itself and that it doesn't demand certain things or it's too proprietary. People tend to keep all these secrets. They're paranoid. And so the community itself is dysfunctional, even though they don't say that they are. They tons of great people within it, and I'm not trying to disparage it because I'm a member of it, but it's, you know, there's some difficult people in it, and they're not always like willing to cooperate or see eye to eye with each other. Now, of course, there's exceptions to all those rules, but anyway, that's my perspective on it, and there's definitely something there. So for Chris Knowles to say there's nothing there is wrong, and for the other group to say, well, we're just being held down by conspiracies, wrong. No, it's just like we're in a system that doesn't, it's fucking broke. The society we live in is broke, and it doesn't facilitate these kind of technologies at the moment. So we need a lot of work before they're out there. But Matt can speak to whatever his opinion is.
I think there's truth in what you said. I think we're ultimately on the same page. I guess it's just a matter of maybe a difference of degree. I'm much more conspiratorial. I think we have. It's like there's someone playing whack-a-mole on us. when, I don't know if you know that game, and they had it in Chuck E.
Cheese. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. All right, you know what I mean? Yeah. So as soon as someone pops up with free energy, you know, they can't be bought out or blackmailed or somehow controlled, then they're shot and killed. And this is there's so many cases of this. Eugene Malov, actually, there's a book Brian O'Leary put together, which includes Eugene Malov and just a ton of scientists who have been killed. I mean, I was looking forward to meeting Ken Shoulders. John and I have talked about this until I found out that he had died of a fast-acting cancer. He had done a lot of very experimentally making some very significant tangible results. And so, you know, I would have gone out and seen him and wanted to see whatever he would show me, but he's, yeah, I think fast acting cancer is a common way to take people out. Other scientists that I've spoken to who are out of the field, they've gotten spooked. For example, Adam Trombley, you know, he has built a homopolar generator, which is a free energy device that was confiscated from him by the government and has had his hand slapped many times after that. So he's kind of moved on to other things. So this is what we're dealing with. And, you know, I guess, knowing this, if anyone asks why are you scared going into it or whatnot, I mean, it's, you know, well, there's multiple reactions to this. You might say like an unbalanced reaction I might have would be that I'm quite actually pissed off at all this. That, like, you know, I went to university thinking I was learning the forefront of modern science and wisdom and all this, but no, I'm it's actually completely compartmentalized. All the good stuff is being kept away, even though it's been paid for by our tax dollars. And, you know, it's, what if they're going to threaten me or whatnot? I mean, it's the question of, you know, living, dying on your feet or living on your knees. I mean, it's, you know, I didn't learn all this physics just to go quietly through the rest of my life, keeping to myself, not trying to get this information out, but, you know, having to learn it first. I'm not saying I even know what needs to be shared just yet. Where else was I going to go with this?
Did you find your thought? Or?
No, I haven't.
I want to chase that rabbit a little bit of the conspiracy side. But before we do, can you address the other side of that, though, the idea of the sort of state of the technology? Is it a, as you say, almost like a philosopher's stone in the sense, how literal do we take that metaphor you made? Is it a sort of pipe dream we're chasing, or is it, do you think it's something that will have actionable technology in X amount of years? And then after you answer that question, I'd like to dig into that conspiracy a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely there. I mean, it's just a matter of having it come out. I mean, John and I were talking about this earlier. It's an intricate puzzle because part of the dollar, our whole money system is based on energy. Like back in the 70s and 80s, I mean, in particular, I mean, even the term petrodollar, it says it all right there, that the dollar is being backed by a form of energy, which a cabal basically has a monopoly disguised as an oligopoly. It's a bit like a catch-22 because once we get free energy out there, there's actually less of a need for money. It ties into, it's almost a bit silly that some people, the scientists who have discovered free energy, they want to get rich, but once they keep it to themselves and then they're bought out and it never gets out there. But if they would release it, then we wouldn't need money after that. I mean, it may take some time for that to happen, but that's kind of the nature of the economics there.
So that's a very specific point that I saw someone had put up online, and you guys might be familiar with this, Buckminster Fuller. It was a quote of his that was saying, basically, there's no need for 90-something percent of the population to have a job if, mm-hmm. 5% of the population can come up with an idea that will sustain everyone else. And I thought, it's the I don't know, sociopolitical ramifications of an idea like that are so loaded in today's political arena, mm-hmm. And even just, as you say, John made the idea that this system is broken, because we live in a system where it's right. Like the guy develops something, and he's like, well, this has to take care of me, but right. It could fucking take care of everybody.
Exactly.
It's like, so like, yeah, where do we sort of draw that line? It's such a fascinating, it's a fascinating thing that's sort of embedded in this whole conversation.
Yeah. And the Philosopher's Stone, I think, is a really apropos, analogy, because even like the original Philosopher's Stone, it's a multi-layered concept. On the most base level, it can turn base metals into gold, but it's also on a higher level. It's about understanding nature or understanding the self, or maybe it's an analogy actually of through wisdom and these meditation practices to transform the self, or maybe the whole experience of life is an alchemical process to transmute ourselves, starting as from essentially lead into a golden being, metaphorically, and a similar kind of thinking is what would probably be needed to bring free energy out, because it's almost like we're in this mentality of a zero sum game, and this is even just classical economics, that it's common thinking that like some people think that economics is a zero sum game. It's kind of like a poker table where the amount that someone wins, someone else has to lose. But no, that's not the case. It's the common analogy that's given of it. You could have a carpenter and a doctor living on the island, and they would exchange goods and services with each other, and they both benefit. And so it's a similar, it's one type of analogy, but that's a similar kind of thinking that I think it would need to get us into this paradigm of free energy, because it's also, we have to change the way that we think about the world and what we do with our time, and maybe even the purpose of life, in a sense. So
let me throw a few sort of challenging thoughts here, because I agree. I think it was my friend Justin Morgan. He designed like the book Sync book covers and stuff like that. He made the point that the idea of the alchemist trying to turn lead into gold was almost like a psych out. It was a way of weeding out this almost like spiritually impure. If you're really just interested in physical gold, well, then you're going to get lost down that rabbit hole and never actually find the true spiritual gold. You're never going to transmute your heart. That being said, when we're talking about developing technologies, one could argue that, let's say you know somebody who has the most incredible idea for a free energy device, but he might need $1 million in current resources to develop the damn thing. So there's this sort of like reliance on the old system before the paradigm can be shifted. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there's some real truth to that sort of, I don't know, almost catch 22. And I guess, so you give this idea there was a really specific point I wanted to make, but okay, so just let's just go back there to a second. So like, if we need current resources to make this happen, do you have an idea of how is, you know, is this a in your mind, is this something that we as a society, you know, almost like a global Kickstarter type idea, you know, like where we can, hey, this is, we make this a priority. You know, we were able to put a man on the moon. We should be able to make something that's energy for everyone. Is this, how do you see that playing out?
I think, I mean, there's a good precedent with Tesla. He spent some time in Colorado Springs, which very briefly, I was just wanted to ask where you went to in Colorado.
Sure, yeah, I don't mind. We were in Denver for most of the time.
Okay. I just can't, because we're playing a bit connect the dots, because when we first spoke in December, I was in Colorado.
Where are you now?
Right now I'm in Los Angeles.
Actually, okay.
In Simi Valley, where they filmed Poltergeist.
That's right. I was going to say, because I just, for a second there, my heart stopped. I was going to say, if you were in Colorado when I was just there for 3 or 4 days, I would be so upset that I didn't see you. Because I actually was, I was able to see Will Morgan, I was able to see Frater X, I was able to see a few people along this trip, so if you were there, I would have been upset that I missed you.
Okay, yeah. But when we spoke, I had a couple of brothers that live in Seattle that were also in Colorado with me, and at the time, David was in Seattle. So in a way, we've kind of been just connecting the dots around the country here. So Tesla back in, I think it was the late 1800s, early 1900s, was in Colorado Springs for a period of time. And this is where he was testing his prototype, or at least the principles that would go into his building of the Wardenclyffe Tower on Long Island, which is essentially a free energy device. To answer your question, how would this play out? What would ideally, it would basically a proof of concept, which is something that hopefully wouldn't take millions of dollars, but enough to demonstrate a certain principle that could then be enough to showcase to investors that it would be, you know, that the proof of concept would be enough to show that this would work on the larger scale. And, you know, maybe we have to go out of the country to do this and try to find another government that would, you know, be willing to lend their military to help protect us against ourselves here, but I think that's where,
because your stance is, because your stance is that once someone has this proof of concept, either the investors come in to buy it up and keep it quiet because they might work for oil interests or whomever, or so that thing either gets bought and buried, or if the person's able to prove it and doesn't sell. So, you know, you mentioned some of these scientists being killed off. What was, why can't I think of the guy's name? Had like the Cloudbuster, Wilhelm Reich. Wilhelm Reich, yes. You know, this is our own government going in and doing this. This is 100 years ago. Somebody, you know, having the government step in and say, you are forbidden to develop this technology. We're going to destroy your lab.
Yeah.
You know, so that's at this point has become a sort of quasi-famous, although, you know, certainly not mainstream, but more so than a lot of other things. Would you say this is happening, I don't know, you know, 5 people, 50 people, 500 people? What do you have a sort of image in mind of what's happening, or is this like an epidemic? I've heard stories of, you know, plenty of scientists being killed off, especially over the last few years. There have been a lot of stories of that, but then I don't know how much of that is some sort of political intrigue of between, you know, nations, or at what point it's because someone was working in something, let's call it forbidden sciences.
Yeah, I mean, there was a slew of them. I know biologists. There was one period of time where some of them were getting killed off, and that may be more just to protect or keep them from whistleblowing, perhaps. Or who knows what? That's really just speculation on my part. But yeah, I would think that this type of thing goes on at least a few times per decade throughout most of the 20th century. And it could even be much higher, you know, because we don't hear about what we don't hear about. Anyone who's going to be doing this, you have to decide, right? What are you going to sell out? Who, you know, are you only going to take investors that would sign a contract so that this patent goes into the public domain? You know, these are the kind of, you know, you have to know where your lines are before you go into this. So otherwise, you'll just be silenced again. So I think this is the kind of the mindset that one has to have.
I think what usually happens with the inventors is they are kind of done in by the patent system, where I know or have read of a number of cases where if it's not outright rejected because uses the wrong language in framing your invention. So if you even mention zero point energy or something, they're probably going to just send it back to you without any. But anyway, what can happen is if you're lucky enough to get a patent, I think what can happen is that there's like gag orders put on you as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of legal strings that are attached to all your applications and the stuff that you get credit for or endorsement by the patent office. Well, now you have to play by certain rules. And I've heard of gag orders being put on certain folks and having their stuff basically falling under a national security order saying, you know, this is national security, so we can't talk about it. I've heard more about that than people being offed. I have heard of certain people being offed. I'm forgetting his name, but he was playing with some Overunity electromagnetics and Baranov, and he was pushed off at the top of a building. Mm-hmm. They say it was a suicide, but that was sketchy. Gene Malov is undecided. I see why someone might be led to thinking he was offed.
I mean, that was like the same day when I think it was David Wilcock and Richard Hoagland that were going to have him on Coast to Coast. And it was around the same time that he was just suddenly killed.
He was on Coast to Coast, I believe, right before he was murdered. And then maybe they were going to have him back on or something. So,
yeah, because he was going to bring on a free energy device and actually show it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because he was at that moment in time, he was in cooperation with the Corias. And the Corias are one of the groups that I think have actually had a working device and still do somewhere, wherever they are in Canada. But it was based on plasma tubes, kind of like Henry T. Moray's were, and like Ken Shoulders are. So there's some relevance to the plasma that is at work there. But beside that, I mean, I think, like I said, there's good reason to go down that path and say, well, he was probably killed by so-and-so. But he might have just been murdered by thugs or breaking into his house. I don't really know. But I do. So what I'd say is that we can really stand on firm ground saying is that like these people are often put under gag orders if they've been fortunate enough to have their stuff that has a certain amount of promise be patented or be protected or endorsed by some group. But it's interesting. It's just an interesting history because it's like it is very it's fucking shady for sure. I don't see how you couldn't find it interesting.
Yeah. And for sure, I mean, you know, I couldn't help but think about this as my whole, I just did what was essentially a cross-country drive, not coast to coast. Oh, there's, you know, of course, coast to coast. But it was essentially cross-country drive and, you know, stopping for gas every few hours. And I'm thinking, this is it. You know, it's like, what... To turn that faucet off, for whoever owns that, and yet at the same time, you could, if someone really wants to be a dick, I mean, you know, if someone's going to step in and buy up a patent or you know become an investor just to bury it, they could become an investor to sell it, can't they? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like if let's say someone wanted to make money off this, you're the head of Citgo or BP or whatever, and you want to, instead of smushing this, this could be your product? Or do you think that's not the case, that once it's out, it's out?
Well, if someone wanted to sell it, who would they sell it to? I mean, it would be a challenge. That would be the challenge right there, even if it was owned by an individual, because you're playing on a playing field, you know, that is essentially owned by other people. I mean, you have to be very strategic about it. I mean, if I came up with something, I would go to, well, Project Camelot, for instance. I would go to you, Alan, actually, if you wanted to broadcast this. I would go to Alex Jones, actually just as many people in the alternative media as possible. The primary goal is just to get it out and let the pieces fall where they may. I mean, this is actually why I have a career in, why I've continued with my career in computer programming, because I don't want to have this leverage against me. Like, I don't want to get into a point where I have to produce or I have to make money off of this, because then that's going to affect my decision making. Bottom line is just getting the information out. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that does. I here's something I would like to do. I know, John, you've actually interviewed Matt before. And Matt, I think you said you had interviewed Randy Powell a while back, right?
That's right, yeah.
Which regardless, I didn't mean to make this about Randy Powell. I just wanted to point that out, is that I can link up these previous interviews you guys have done where you've been the interviewer. But I want you to kind of step into that role right here. John, what do you think would be a good question to ask Matt? And Matt, what do you think would be a good question to ask John? I kind of want you guys to step into those roles for just a moment, if you don't mind.
That's a good question. I can go first with my question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I think we kind of touched on this earlier, so what do you think is the most promising free energy technology right now, and what's the current state of it?
Okay, the most promising free energy device right now, so beyond cold fusion, right?
It could include cold fusion. I was actually expecting you to.
Because I don't think it's really fair, because I think cold fusion is really far ahead at the moment. I'm not saying it's the better alternative in the long, long run, but it's there now and it's pretty well developed. So, and there's four companies that are basically on the verge of getting something out. Now, it'll probably get co-opted first, but over time it'll seep out into the public, and I think it'll be that stepping stone for the next stage of like energy evolution. So as of now, it's definitely cold fusion. Whatever cold fusion is, whether it is actual fusion taking place in a palladium lattice or a nickel lattice matrix or whatever they're using in those things, that's one theory. The other theory is some kind of zero point extraction going on, some kind of hot fusion complementing weak interactions, resulting in mass transmutations, which result in heat. So there's these competing theories about what's going on. Personally, I think it's probably some kind of fusion. I think it's just a multi-body effect that is unusual in this kind of very far from equilibrium situation, in either a wet electrochemical scenario or system, or a gas-driven nickel system. They both operate off this paradigm. So we don't know, we don't have enough information to know what's going on, but we know these fucking things work really well. And now these guys seem to have some technology, like Rossi is partnered with a guy in North Carolina. Defcolion or DGT is in Canada and Greece, and they're up there. Brillouin is in California, and they just signed a contract with South Korea to outfit all their basically in disuse nuclear plants with their cold fusion boiler technologies. So that'll be the first real opportunity to scale them up that we know about. We don't know what Rossi's doing with his. But,
what's the best theory or ideas? Like, how are these nuclei actually able to get so close together to actually fuse?
I think these things called cluster fusion hypotheses are the best. Now, there's a handful of them that I think are the best, but I don't know which one to settle on. There's what's going on, okay, the basic framework for what's going on is that the reaction is taking place at the surface of your reacting solid state material. So whether that's some kind of nickel foam core or it's a palladium lattice, you have some kind of structure that the reaction is taking part in. So you load that structure full of deuterium. You inject it in there until it's basically a deuterium to palladium ratio of close to 1:1. And then what you have is a far from equilibrium, highly elastic environment for the nuclei to interact with each other. And so if you have the right kind of electric flux running through the system, or current density is another way of saying it, is that brings all these things piling through these what are called nuclear active environments. So they're either these small nano cracks, or they're nano crevices, or there's some kind of nano cavity within the structure, because there's defects in every structure. And the current density will crack these things apart to a point where it doesn't, they don't lose deuterium, but they're able to create these small environments where a nuclear reaction can take part in a chemical environment, which is very strange, because you'd expect a bunch of chemical products or chemical reactions to take place if it was in the chemical environment, i.e. it's in the lattice, but it wasn't there. So they're seeing it in the surface, and it has to be in this kind of vacancy that is not a lattice vacancy. It's a like an artificial stress-driven one. So anyway, all the shit's clustering in there, and we don't know what the structure is. It's either like a Bose-Einstein condensate that can form from femtoseconds and then disappear, but it can initiate like an overlap of their wave functions, and then they distribute the gammas through their kinetic energy, their momentum, and the lattice absorbs some, and so it gets dissipated in several ways, and so that's why you don't see any radiation. So those hypotheses, and there's probably like, you know, again, four or five, but I've given the outline of all of them, and they all argue about the finer points, but that's what I think is good. The leading theory out there now is called Wittem-Larsen theory, which has to do with weak interactions and mass transmutations, and that might be going on in nickel systems, but it's not going on in palladium overall, so I don't think that's the mechanism, but it could be, but NASA's staking their bets on it, so that's my favorite kind of theory as far as that goes, if I gave it another line for it.
Yeah, cool.
I guess a question I have for you is, all right, so if we violate the speed of light, okay, we have UFOs and whatnot, if they're going faster than the speed of light, what do we do with Einstein? How much does that break apart his work? Because I thought we could retain a lot of it while still just expanding the domains of our universe to a point or a regime where light can propagate faster than, or not light, but signals and whatnot can propagate faster than light. So are we actually going faster than light? Is that an illusion? Extent does that underwrite the Einsteinian view?
Right. Well, okay. I could answer, I guess. Yeah. Anytime, because it's kind of strange, because I have all these different, I have like a mindset in so many different ways. It's kind of like I have 10 people speaking in my head at once when I'm asked a question. It's like the academic versus the alternative physicist. But I guess what to start at one angle. I do think that. Just personally, that we can move faster than the speed of light. The paradigm of, let's just start with special relativity. I mean, it is so fundamental in the basic equations of special relativity that light is an upper limit. I mean, it's built into it. that it would really it would be difficult to change. I mean, it would no longer be special relativity. Basically, it would be called something else entirely, because it would be an entirely different mathematical model. So as far as how that could be kept, it's a bit like asking if you have like a sphere, and say you found a corner on it, then what would you call it? Like how would you, it's like asking how would you fix the sphere? Well, it wouldn't be a sphere anymore. I guess maybe that's one way to put it.
But we're still retaining a bit of it, or quite a bit, because I mean, a sphere, even with a tip on it, is still largely a sphere, right? So it's something different, but aren't we retaining much of it, even if we're tweaking something that seems fundamental? I mean, is it all just totally collapsing in on itself?
Or
could it be that special relativity is only explaining a certain, again, it has limits, like Newtonian physics has its limits. Everything seems to work in a certain domain, and while there's bleed through, everything has its limits. So could there be something operating around that, that something like entanglement insinuates that there's another domain beyond that, even though it's valid in its own way?
Right. Actually, yeah, that is a really good point. I mean, that is a good perspective, because even though, like you said, that Newtonian physics is insufficient to account for the slight precession in the orbit of Mercury and other phenomenon like the bending of starlight, it can still be used, and so it would probably be we could still use special relativity as an approximation, but it would no longer be fundamental. Like we couldn't say that this is the true nature of space and time. It's only used, you know, for particular practical purposes and particular paradigms. So it would be a philosophical overhaul in that sense, insofar as physics is a natural philosophy. Or if that sufficient to answer, but
yeah. Okay, and one more thing. To what extent was ancient technology a part of ancient civilizations, in your opinion? And was it coded in their myths? And like we've already touched on a bit in the tarot, but do you see it in other myths or languages as well?
Okay. I generally don't consider myself a, what do they say on the History Channel? An ancient astronomer theorist. Laviolette's work actually goes quite a bit into this. I mean, the zodiac does literally point to the center of the galaxy and periods of active galactic explosions. And this is something that just to kind of touch on this important point, I think that when we look out at other galaxies, about half of, or a good percentage of them, I want to say somewhere maybe between 40% to 60%, are in what's called an active state. So that the central star, some call it a black hole, although Hawking recently changed his opinion about whether or not black holes exist. But a large percentage of these galaxies are in an active state, where there is an intense amount of radiation being transmitted outward from the center. And so if we're looking out at all these different galaxies, like in these various states, you know, maybe this is oscillatory, you know, maybe it's not just inherent to certain galaxies. Maybe they all, it's just kind of a property that galaxies occasionally go through this state. So, you know, back however many tens of thousands or thousands of years ago that our galaxy was last in this active state, that would be recorded in various, legends. And in the Hopi speak about this. I think this might have been a time of much more electric plasma there might have been a lot more plasma phenomenon. And so, you know, you have these people that are part of the Electric Universe umbrella that talk about a lot of this type of seeing these things in the sky that have gone into their pictures, that people drawing these same pictures all over the world. And it can be explained quite nicely by electromagnetic phenomenon that they see in the sky that may be related to this periodic active state. As far as ancient stuff or cultures, it's not something that I read too much about. You know, I don't have a television, so occasionally I do see the History Channel, Ancient Aliens, at a friend's house, but it's not something that I keep too up with too much. So that's about the extent of it, I think.
Well, like the pyramids, for example. I mean, what do you think the pyramids were used for?
Initiation and healing. That was at least the original intent. And I'm answering this via the law of one, because they speak a lot about this. That's kind of where this would come from. But yeah, it does make use of prana, chi. It essentially acts as a scoop and a focus of these more subtle energies for the purposes of, like I said, initiation and healing primarily.
Okay, so it's almost like a meditation chamber, right?
That's one of the applications.
Okay. Now, I've heard that they go in there at times. They were initiations or healing rituals or whatever, but they had the shamanic flavor where they would mix psychedelics with the experience. And I know of some psychedelics that the Egyptians had access to and might have been using in those places to amplify the experience. And not only that, but if people were in there and there was maybe a priest or something somewhere else hidden in the temple, they could use the acoustics of the place to create this environment where, again, your consciousness became basically more entangled with the background, so to speak, or more non-local. You became non-localized to a degree. So I wonder if, again, it's speculation a bit, but I mean, do you think that's like within the realm of reason of what they were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would add that I think the earliest teachings, the way that these were originally used, they did not use psychedelics. It wasn't necessary. It was only during the decline where I think they had lost their a lot of the original teachings that they would use the psychedelics as kind of like a boost, you might say, to get into these other states of mind that previously were not necessary.
Right. Yeah. People have gotten into these states in a lot of different ways in a lot of different cultures. So some use deprivation, you know, you hear the cliche of the vision quest where you just go out and become dehydrated and you hallucinate. You can do psychedelics, or you can do, there are other tribes that used, you know, pain rituals, which are not necessarily pleasant. I mean, they weren't killing anybody, but, you know, hooks into flesh and stuff. So to induce these kind of visions. So everybody had this kind of way of inducing it, and everybody, you know, back in a time when there was more understanding of this process, they were probably able to do it without it. But at the same time, it also seems to be, even removing it from the Egyptian environment or context, psychedelics seem to have impact in other cultures in terms of bringing out like knowledge from space. And that's why I think it's that whole subject matter is so interesting, because not only does it have very practical scientific applications as far as unifying forces and so on and so forth, it opens up these ideas again of like, what is consciousness and how are we connected to space? And so maybe, again, I want to make sure we cover it, but it's like, how do we think sync works? So Alan, we can bring you back, because I know you have ideas about it too.
Sure, I like
that idea of like, how do we think this is working? What is it telling us, and what use is it, and like how can we model it?
Well, I actually, if you don't mind, I was actually about to jump in, because when you spoke about this idea that there was a time previously where maybe there were specific teachings that were lost, and then the, you know, and that they're at some point we're in decline and we have to use these amplification tools. I wonder, do you subscribe to the concept of like a Kali Yuga type thing that's responsible for this decline? Is it a law or just a lost teaching? You know, whether that's a more political answer of like book burnings, you know, a flood, you know, it could be a natural disaster, something that would happen that would disrupt the flow of information and wisdom being passed down, or is it more like a cosmic feng shui where, okay, right now you're out of the path of that particular energy, and now you're in the, you know, the dark night of the globe?
Yeah, I would say both as a short answer.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious because when you said that. So, John, as far as you asking about how does sync work, I mean, when you bring this in, I mean, you know, I got to a point where I speak to so many different people with different theories, and I see, on a very intuitive level, I see where they all overlap. And in a sense, that's sort of, that's what synchronicity is, right? I wish I could find, if I could recall it, there was a really beautiful poetic sentence in a Kurt Vonnegut book. Oh, let's see, that was Sirens of Titan. He describes something that he calls something infundibulum, right? Which, of course, even in itself, implies a spiral. It's the spiraling motion down a funnel. And if you guys actually give me a second, I have that book on my shelf right there. I can grab it.
Yeah. Grab it.
That would be my most poetic answer for what sync is. Hold on.
So you don't want to get into Gödel's theorem this time around, huh?
We could if you want to, but I'm actually reading, I read about it a bit in Actors and Points.
Okay.
So that actually helped make it all concrete, be more concrete. So I'd seen something of Gödel's theorem before we taught, and then you gave me a good treatment on it. And I think it's very, I mean, the philosophical questions it opens up are endlessly fascinating. And applies to consciousness, it absolutely has applications and paints an understanding. In the same way Penrose brings it up, why does Penrose bring it up? For the same reason, it's to give a frame for what is consciousness or what isn't consciousness, and then where do we go from there? Because it's not algorithmic, it's nonlinear, it's a lot of things that it isn't. I mean, it's not just not a computer, so we have to, maybe it's beyond description, maybe it just is, but that idea of Gödel's theorem gives a clearer picture. But if you want to, Al, are you back?
Oh yeah, I'm here. I'm just going to let you guys keep going. But if you guys decide if you want to go there tonight, we can go anywhere you want, whether that's tonight or any time in the future. So if you want to, if there's something you want to kind of reacquaint yourself with or something, just don't hesitate to do that, and we will have you guys back anytime you want.
Well, I still have a little time. I mean, Matt, it's up to you how much time you have left.
Oh no, I just meant if there was a specific subject that you didn't feel ready to speak to tonight.
Oh no, that's all good.
Okay. So I'm gonna read this real quick. This is from Kurt Vonnegut's Sirens of Titan, and this is a book that has been a continued source of synchronicity for me, and actually, for anyone who's familiar with the graphic novel Watchmen, which they made a movie out of a few years ago, which is actually involves free energy, it's a very specific, it's actually something that I keep kind of picturing in my mind as we talk, Dr. Manhattan, he's able to make these elements, and that allows for what's essentially free energy, or I guess maybe more of a middle ground. But anyway, I feel like Watchmen was based very, it's either an incredible synchronicity or it borders on plagiarism. This book, The Sirens of Titan, one of Kurt Vonnegut's first novels. And in it, he describes, so I'm just going to read about a page and a half here. Winston Niles Rumford had run his private spaceship right into the heart of an uncharted chronosynclastic infundibulum 2 days out of Mars. Only his dog had been along. Now Winston Niles Rumford and his dog Kazakh existed as wave phenomena, apparently pulsing in a distorted spiral, with its origin in the sun and its terminal in Betelgeuse. The Earth was about to intercept that spiral. Almost any brief explanation of Chronos and classic infundibula is certain to be offensive to specialists in the field. Be that as it may, the best brief explanation is probably that of Dr. Cyril Hall, which appears in the 14th edition of A Child's Cyclopedia of Wonders and Things to Do. The article is here reproduced in full, with gracious permission from the publishers. Quote, Chronosynclastic infundibula. Just imagine that your daddy is the smartest man who ever lived on Earth, and he knows everything there is to find out, and he's exactly right about everything, and he can prove he is right about everything. Now imagine another little child on some nice world a million light years away, and that little child's daddy is the smartest man who ever lived on that nice world so far away. And he is just as smart and just as right as your daddy is. Both daddies are smart, and both daddies are right. Only, if they ever met each other, they would get into a terrible argument, because they wouldn't agree on anything. Now, you can say that your daddy is right, and the other little child's daddy is wrong, but the universe is an awfully big place. There is room enough for an awful lot of people to be right about things and still not agree. The reason both daddies can be right and still get into terrible fights is because there are so many different ways of being right. There are places in the universe, though, where each daddy could finally catch on to what the other daddy was talking about. These places are where all the different kinds of truths fit together as nicely as the parts in your daddy's solar watch. We call these places chronosynclastic infundibula. The solar system seems to be full of chronosynclastic infundibula. There is one great big one we are sure of that likes to stay between Earth and Mars. We know about that one because an Earthman and his dog ran right into it. You might think it would be nice to go to a chronosynclastic infundibulum and see all the different ways to be absolutely right, but it is a very dangerous thing to do. The poor man and his poor dog are scattered far and wide, not just through space, but through time, too. Chrono means time, synclastic means curved toward the same side in all directions, like the skin of an orange. Infundibulum is what the ancient Romans, like Julius Caesar and Nero, called a funnel. If you don't know what a funnel is, get mommy to show you one. And that's, I think, one of the most poetic ways of doing it.
Yeah, thank you for reading that. I enjoyed that.
Hmm. That was Sirens of Titan?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a good book. So, when I was grabbing the book, what were you Matt? You were asking John about something specific.
Oh, it may be because Kurt Vonnegut and Kurt Gödel share a same first name, but I was kind of jokingly asking why, or if you didn't want to get into Gödel's theorem right now. But it is getting a little late, so it's not something I want to push.
But I was saying Gödel's theorem is very interesting because it does apply to consciousness and trying to explore what is consciousness or what is not consciousness. So without getting into it, really, anyone interested in it should look that up and see what it says about mathematics and how it applies to the human brain. I think it's an interesting question. So that's what we were just mentioning while you were off getting your book.
Okay.
Matt's talked about it a lot in our interview. So if anyone's interested, they can find it there.
Well, that's actually where I wanted to kind of take this. What? For all the things we've talked about today, is there somewhere I should be directing people, or something people should be Googling, Wikipedia-ing, whatever it might be, to get a grasp on this? What are some recommendations for resources?
I think, well, there's a couple books. I think Gödel, Escher, Bach is a classic. It actually won the 1979 Pulitzer Prize. Not to say that that is what motivated me to continue with mathematics and the foundations of mathematics. Just asking, you know, what is truth? He does it in a very balanced right brain, left brain way. He incorporates the music of Bach and the art of Escher. So it's really a beautiful, stimulating book. And then a second one would be Shadows of the Mind by Roger Penrose. And this is more of a mathematical, well, it's along similar themes. I mean, I think both these books share the crux of exploring the phenomenon of consciousness, whereas Roger Penrose looks more into the puzzles and the beauty of mathematics and physics as it applies to this. These were very influential works, I would say, for me.
There's a lot of good stuff. I mean, it's hard for me to suggest any one particular thing. I'll say subject matters that are interesting and people would want to look into. And anything in occult fusion, I think, is really worth it for anyone that's adventurous. And it's important to have an open mind when you're looking through literature. Almost no matter what you're looking at, it's just like, how are you taking it in, and how are you profiling in your mind? So go ahead and read like mainstream authors. That's good, and they have a lot to say. But go and read something completely nuts that is going to challenge you.
Right,
and
right.
See if you can incorporate any of it into your schema and challenge yourself.
I second that recommendation. For real, yeah. I think there's immense value to be found in some of the crazier reaches.
And it doesn't even, and it can still appeal to you intellectually. I mean, try to look for something that's suggested as rigorous. I mean, if you're not in a new age or something, there's a lot of avenues to get into alternative subjects that are pretty rigorous and scholarly and very interesting. And so there's a lot of good books on free energy. There's some not as good. I mean, going to websites and stuff isn't too useful. It's good to find a book and to sit down with it. And the ones Matt suggested are good. If not that there aren't good websites, but anything on complexity theory is really interesting. Open systems are very interesting, and understanding that kind of I feel like there's a philosophy embedded in that kind of science, as there is in free energy too. But that whole idea of a process and cooperation and that type of emergent properties from the dynamics of individuals. So how do we cooperate, and how does that create something good or create something novel and special? So understanding those dynamics, I think we can apply to human systems as well. So it has a lot of applications and utility. So as far as the science goes, anything on complexity theory, you can't really go wrong. All of them are going to tell you something good. But guys like Stuart Kaufman, Mei-Hwan Ho, Sally Gorner, Melanie Mitchell, Ilya Prigogine won the Nobel Prize. He practically invented the field. So he's a guy to consult to. But anyway, so those are more like, if you're into mainstream stuff, open systems are good. And then there's some good free energy books, especially the ones about history. Nick Cook's Hunt for Zero Point, and there's another one called The Light Bulb, The Thief, and the something or other that documents free energy history and gives a balanced accounting of it. So those are probably the best places to start, just to get a viewpoint. And then, you know, do some exploring and, like I said, find something that will challenge you and see what you resonates and what doesn't.
Yeah. This is why I like talking to John, because obviously you can see he's very wide expanse of exploring different information there.
Oh, absolutely. I enjoy John for the same reason. Yeah, both of you. I mean, this was a real pleasure for me. I was a bit intimidated going into this, even when I had been planning, you know, sort of to have you guys on. Wasn't sure how I was going to be able to kind of keep up with the two of you. And then after doing 3.5 days of driving and not sleeping very much, I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this. But you guys did an excellent job of explaining your concepts, not going too far over my head, but really giving, I think, answers that are conceptually understandable, but leave room for if someone wants to do the research and see, you know, what you're actually pointing to. I just really commend you both for for what you've done here tonight, but really for just what you've been doing on a larger scale. I think both of you are just really intelligent and really wonderful guys that I'm just really happy I was able to have the pleasure to speak to you guys tonight.
Cool. Thanks. Well, it's always a pleasure to be on your show and with SyncBook.
Yeah, that's another, John, you said there are a few good websites out there. SyncBook.com. No.
Seriously, the production value on the site is like ridiculous for it's just like a labor of love for you, and it's really well done.
Thank you.
I don't even know how much time goes into creating all like the graphic art and stuff, but all the posters for all the shows, it's always like funny to see what you come up with, because they're always very creative, but they're funny, you know, they're humorous, but they're get to the heart of what the show is about once you listen to the whole thing.
For real, thank you for bearing with me today. For listeners, these guys are just really, really awesome for not only always doing great work, but also for just being really nice about allowing a number of rescheduling today as things got crazy. And one of those things is was my fault trying to coordinate while doing this road trip. And the other thing is that David was very sick today and couldn't be here. And we just, our thoughts go out to David and hope he's doing well. And thank you again, John and Matt. And I hope everyone will check out their work and have a wonderful night.
Good. Thanks, Alan.
Okay, thanks again. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, guys.
All right, later.
Scientist, maybe I'm no better, but I'm not, so I don't. And if I was a nuclear physicist, maybe things would be different, but I'm not, so they are. And if I was half the man I was, maybe it'd be a better world today than it was yesterday. And if I was a rocket scientist, maybe I know better, but I'm not, so I don't. And if I was a better poet, believe me, you'd know it, so I won't even try. What do I do but write some songs about it? What do I do but write some songs about it? What do I do but write some songs? And if I was a chaos theorist, maybe I could see the underlying order, but I'm not, so I can mess it up now. The man I was. Maybe it'd be a better world today than it was yesterday. Scientist, I know better, but I'm not, so I don't. And if I was a rocket scientist, I know better, but I'm not, so I don't.
Science.